try again.
Torah Resource presents The Rob and Caleb Show.
All aboard!
And now, from two sides of the same state, here they are, Rob and Caleb.
What up? Shalom. And welcome to The Rob and Caleb Show. My name is Caleb Hegg, and with me, as always, my friend, my teacher, my mentor, Rob Van Hoff. What up, Rob?
Shalom, Caleb.
How's it going, my friend?
Going well. We're battling the flu here.
Oh, man.
You sent it over to us.
Yeah, well, my wife's getting over it. I just got over it. My voice is still having trouble, so if you hear me cough from time to time, that's what's going on.
My voice always sounds funny, so it doesn't matter.
That's not true. Hey, welcome everyone to the Rob and Caleb Show. And today we are going to do what I am calling the cleanup show. And what I mean by that is we're going to go back through some of the things that have been going on online on our social networking sites and throughout some of the interaction that we've had via email and all sorts of stuff. We really stirred up a hornet's nest this past week, and we're going to try to clean some of that up. We're going to talk about a bunch of different issues. And basically, it's all over Paleo Hebrew. And before we jump into this, I do have to say a big special thanks to our friend LaRue. She was kind of talking with people about the exact same thing, this Paleo Hebrew that's been running rampant in the Messianic movement. And she knew that we did a show about it. So she went back, found our fourth show that we did, which was all about Paleo Hebrew. And she made a transcript of it and sent it to us. And she made it so that she could print it out and give it to her friends. And so thank you so much, LaRue. We appreciate it. You can find that on our blog. That's right. Torah Resource now has a blog, believe it or not. And it's basically me running the blog. And you can find that at TorahResourceBlog.com. You can leave comments on there. You can leave comments on the Rob and Caleb Show page on TRRadio.com. You can send us an email if you want to. Radio@TorahResource.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Caleb Hegg, and Rob Van Hoff is at Rob Van Hoff, two Fs on Van Hoff.
Double F.
That's right. And Van Hoff has been using his Twitter a bit more. Good job, Rob.
I'm trying to create a new habit, except I realize that, boy, you could get sucked in too. So it's like, you know, I need a safe distance. I need like a, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there are some people who just have it, you know, like they... Some people are really fun to follow on Twitter because they come up with clever things to say in 140 characters all the time. I'm really bad at that. I can't do that. So I try to put good stuff out, but who knows? You know,
and there's stuff I get bombarded with.
Oh,
and I'm
I know.
Just like, okay, I got to eliminate that guy because it's just it just noises up my system, you know?
That's right. All right. Well, so why are we doing a quote-unquote cleanup show? Well, I'll tell you why. Because I posted something on the Torah Resource Facebook page last week, and man, did it stir something up. I think I really ticked some people off. And basically what this was, if you haven't seen it, what I put up was a chart of quote-unquote Paleo Hebrew, ancient text of Hebrew. And underneath the text, it was this chart that had corresponding pictorial meanings, pictographic meanings. I don't think pictorial is a word. Pictographic meanings. So hang on, let me see if I have one pulled up here. Actually, I got a couple of different ones pulled up. And I pulled up a couple of different ones because we had said that there wasn't really a fluid meaning, you know, different people have different meanings. Now, I found that online, from what I've been able to look at today. Now, Rob, maybe you can correct me on this. But from what I've found today, most of these charts actually are exactly the same. So, for instance, they say Aleph means ox head, or it means strong or powerful or leader. And then, like, the Sheen means sharp or teeth or press or eat. So all these, basically what they're saying is these letters have words that, you know, they have a...
Well, and it's tied in not only to... the old, like a what it's a picture of, like for example, you mentioned Aleph. Well, it looks like an ox head, so it's but it's also the name too. Aleph means like a chief or a commander, or it can mean an ox. So the name of the letter itself and the picture are often the same, pointing to the same concept.
So, but let's not get ahead of ourselves here. So first, I want to explain why we're even talking about this. Basically, I put one of these little charts up on Facebook with a circle around it and a red line through it. You know, one of the like do not smoke symbols or something like that. And let me just go to the Facebook page here. If you hear me clicking around, it's because honestly, I've kind of gotten a little riled up this past week about all this. The worst part is that a lot of these people who are all for it are people who would consider not only very strong believers, but people who are in our camp, quote unquote in our camp, might be one law people, might be, messianic Jews or Gentile, but it's all these people are getting wrapped up in this. So the post that I put up said, have you been told that originally the Hebrew alphabet had pictorial meaning? And if you know the meaning of the letters, it will bring a new meaning to the biblical text. And then it has that picture with the line through it, and it says, did you know that there is absolutely no evidence to support this theory? Investigate what is being taught. And then I put the verse, Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 1 through 14, at the bottom of that. So this, there are a good amount of comments on this, 19 different comment threads, and then replies to that. So, and we really ticked some people off. So we already did a show on Paleo Hebrew and pictorial meaning being attached to that. We're gonna talk about it even more today, and the reason why is because we've just gotten so much buzz over this post. So, Rob, let's clear it up. There's a couple of different people who are really advocating this, okay? And there's Jeff Benner. A bunch of people online who said, oh, you haven't looked at, you need to look at Jeff Benner. There's another guy named Dr. Frank Seekins. And basically what they're saying is that we can learn more about the text of the Bible by understanding the pictures that go with the letters. Now, why don't you expand on that? Am I downplaying that? Am I overplaying it? What do you think, Rob?
No, I think you're representing just the conception that's out there. And, for example, I'm on a website called Hebrew for Christians with the number 4.
And that's actually
popular website.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of people send me links to this website. And for example, on he's got a page called Pictograms or Hebrew Consonants. And he's got a chart here similar to the one you describe, where it says Aleph, and then it has a picture of an ox as a pictograph, and then it says ox / strength / leader. And he says that at least he gives a warning here, and this is maybe a leaning in the right direction, but there's some things he says here that are problematic. And if I could just read this paragraph, he says, warning, while the study of the pictographic script can sometimes yield insight into the underlying meaning / etymology of biblical Hebrew words, so that's his first claim, which I would dispute, it is generally to be avoided as a standalone exegetical principle. Well, I think we should avoid it altogether, but
absolutely.
In any case, he says it generally should be avoided as a standalone exegetical principle, since this can lead to speculations and doubtful interpretations. Well, it always will. For honest interpretation, the rule of thumb is to first master the Peshat. Now he's throwing another word at us, plain historical meaning, before moving on to the other quote-unquote levels of the scriptures. And so here's an example of a person who's assuming the word peshat. They're peddling this idea of peshat, which in rabbinic text, peshat is not the plain meaning of the text. The peshat is what the rabbis tell you the text means in its basic level. So there is no self-evident peshat meaning in the rabbinic worldview. So, but this is an example of a Christian or a believer in Yeshua interested in Hebraic thought, pulling a rabbinic concept such as Peshat and then using that in a way that the original rabbis using that word didn't consider. There's a lot of problems. And then the idea that there's multiple levels of scriptures usually gets to the idea of Pardes, Peshat.
And we're going to talk
Remez,
about
Darash. And this is a medieval Kabbalistic conception of scripture that is not from Yeshua's teaching. And so And one last comment on this page on Hebrew for Christians. He then gives the example of the word El for Elohim. He says it's a strong leader. Why? Because it's an ox and a lamed. And, of course, if you look at his chart, you see the lamed means staff, goad, or control. And then, for example, the aleph and the bet or is an ox and a house, therefore means father. And I've seen other people use these as examples. It's very problematic.
Well, okay. So one of the comments, and you know, I'm gonna try to take some of these comments on head on that were left on the Torah Resource Institute Facebook page. One of them says, "So I really think that you should be looking at the info that Jeff Benner is putting out, as it has significant historical validation, ranging from basic hieroglyphs." To Phoenician translation. Okay, first of all, hieroglyphs have absolutely nothing to do with this, in my opinion. And maybe you can correct me, Rob. But the reason why is because Egyptian hieroglyphs is not a Semitic language. So it's like comparing apples to oranges. You can't compare hieroglyphs to a Semitic language. It just doesn't work.
Well, yeah. And even if you were to say that some of the early Canaanite script consisted of some adaptation of an Egyptian hieroglyphic sign. Even in, the ancient Egypt, the hieroglyphs by the time of Moses, you know, by the time of the Middle Kingdom or the New Kingdom, I think it is, it's you know, around the 1500s BC and there and beyond, those hieroglyphic signs come to represent consonants. In other words, they're no longer so. Even if we were just talking about Egypt, if you were in ancient Egypt and you were trained as a scribe or a priest, you'd be using these what we call pictographs, but you wouldn't be reading them as pictographs. You'd be reading them as letters of an alphabet.
Okay,
they would have different signs.
Let me break down what you just said, because that's a great point. And honestly, that's my point. And I think it would be your point when it comes to Semitic languages. Am I saying that Hebrew never, ever had, you know, the letters of Hebrew never had some picture attached to it? No, I'm not saying that. At some point, they might have, way back in the day. But Hebrew evolved. It's an evolving language, and it always has been. Language evolves. All language evolves. And what I'm saying is that after a while, Hebrew became an ABCdery, meaning that each letter took on a sound instead of a pictographic meaning, a picture for a meaning. So when a scribe is writing, just like you just said, when a scribe is writing and they, you know, let's bring it into English to break it down. You know, if I say, I'm going to go buy a new dog, well, then the other person doesn't think to themselves, oh, let's see here. Well, D used to mean, it used to mean door, and O used to mean, opening, and D used to mean, you know.
No, G meant growl.
Yeah. So
that's you open the door and it growls, so it's a dog.
Yeah, I mean, nobody thinks that way. Nobody writes that way, you know, and there's.
Exactly. The names of the we have the name Aleph. Well, it's to help. It's like A is for, it's to help the person
A is for
who's learning a writing system. And the language already, people were speaking the language and they didn't have to think about the alphabet. Just like, you know, kids can learn to speak and communicate without ever learning to read and write.
That is a great point, Rob.
They're just speaking the language.
Check this out. So in 1,000 years, if all of a sudden America is, you know, is no more and you know, the people in the future are doing excavations in Washington State and they find my son's, ABC book and they open it up and they say, oh, look at this. Look right here. A actually stood for apple, and B actually stood for banana, you know, and all the way through, you know, X stood for xylophone. Well, then what we're going to do is we're going to go through any other writing that we see, and we're going to try to attach those meanings to each letter. We can find all new meaning, and that's exactly what people are doing with Hebrew.
You know, a whole other angle on this is that of friend of Tor Resource Institute, is the Noonan family. But Ben Noonan, who finished his PhD at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati.
And just, somebody we're going to do an interview on Tor Resource Radio.
Well, Ben's whole PhD thesis was concentrating on loan words into biblical Hebrew. And so there's a whole dictionary. His whole dissertation is a huge dictionary of words that were not Hebrew that are part of the Torah and part of the Hebrew scriptures. They are loan words taken from other surrounding culture. And you know, but yet these words are spelled with the Hebrew alphabet. Therefore, there must be cosmic significance to them. And, you know, so Ben's approach, Ben's focus is a completely untouched angle that also, you know, takes the myth out of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's you know, I want to change gears. I don't want to get stuck on this on this one section of Paleo Hebrew for too long, because we already talked about Paleo Hebrew in another one of our episodes. So let's move on. We're going to get a little bit deeper into this in a completely different way. First of all, I want to ask the question to you, Rob. Why is it that you think that these issues are actually affecting the Messianic movement, but for the most part, now they have creeped into Christianity a little bit, but for the most part, these issues of Paleo Hebrew and pictures being attached to letters have stayed primarily in the Messianic movement and haven't really worked their way into Christianity yet. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think in broad brushstrokes, there's a few facets to this. One is just blind leaders. Another is the desire of like things Hebraic, quote unquote, or Jewish, and this idea of we can put our own brain aside and submit to some sort of mystical rabbinic authority and tradition to help us discover, you know, new meanings, etc. And on the other hand, there's a rejection of inherited Christian tradition. So people want to hold on to the core gospel message, let's say, but they want to embrace a Jewish Jesus. And with anachronism and lack of scholarship, there's no clear method or approach, no clear grasp of history or languages. There is a parallelomania. In other words, we look up at an English translation of the Zohar, for example, and you find something about the alphabet, and you're going, oh, wow, Yeshua must have believed the same thing, you know, yeah. Although they're over 1,000 years apart. You know, it's just, it's unchecked, haphazard application of, you know, matching of texts different times.
And you bring up a good point, you know, honestly, whether or not we agree with them wholeheartedly or not, and we obviously don't, but Christian scholars today, many Christian scholars, we're getting some of, you know, the greatest scholarship in the Bible right now is coming out of the Christian circles. And, you know, whether or not we agree fully with you know, every scholar, that obviously we don't. But there's good work that's being done by these educated people who are dedicating their lives to do scholarship in the Bible. In Messianic Judaism and Messianic faith, it seems like a lot of the people who are doing the scholarly, quote-unquote, scholarly work don't have degrees, or they are uneducated. They don't speak the original languages. You know, I've noticed that with some of these gentlemen, and I'm going to first say, you know, I think these people that are doing this work, they're not doing it out of malice or anything, but a true love for the Almighty and a true faith in Yeshua. And they are really trying to, you know, further the faith. But a lot of them claim to have 20, 30 years in the Hebrew language, and then they can't even pronounce their letters. It seems like they can't even read Hebrew. You know, they can't put together a Hebrew sentence. So I'm wondering what kind of scholarship they've done with the Hebrew languages. So I think really what it comes down to, why we're not seeing these same kind of, you know, what I would call errors in the Christian circles, is scholarship. It just comes down to pure scholarship. All right, so let's move on. Now, we're going to get into a realm that's much more Rob Vanhoff's, his expertise. and that is rabbinics, because a lot of this seems, it seems like we've had these same kind of conversations and these same kind of arguments go on since the time of Yeshua. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about the different hermeneutic of Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva. Now, Rabbi Ishmael and Akiva both were in the late 1st to early 2nd century. Akiva, if you are unaware of who Rabbi Akiva was, Rabbi Akiva proclaimed that Bar Kokhba was the Messiah, and he obviously was wrong on that, of course, and he tried to help lead the revolt with Bar Kokhba, and Rabbi Akiva was quite a mystic. Now, Rob, I'm going to pass this over to you since this is your area of expertise. Why don't you talk a little bit about who Rabbi Akiva was and Rabbi Ishmael and what the difference is between their hermeneutics?
Oh, will do. Gladly. You know, we're this quarter we have a first at Torah Resource Institute, a first offering of a class I've been excited about for a long time, contemporary Judaisms. You know, and I did not make a prerequisite of which I'm considering for the future offerings of this same class to have our introduction to rabbinic literature be a prerequisite. And Caleb, I know you've been through the introduction through rabbinic literature course. It's I know it's like drinking from a fire hose. There's just a lot to get through.
A lot of material.
And I've had some students have gone through the course multiple times and they get a lot out of it the first time, and they do it again and go, wow, this is, you know, I'm glad I did it a second time. There's just, and that's not my design. That's just because the nature of the beast, it's pretty big. And, you know, my bottom line is that any rabbinic text that's, if we're going to study it at all, should be studied in its own right and not as like a reference book to first century world of Yeshua. Yeah. You know, it needs to be respected
as what it is.
Yeah, is what they are. And Jacob Neusner was a big proponent of that because in his day, there was a lot of that parallelomania going on. And it drove him crazy, you know. And there's a lot of scholars in Neusner's wake. One is my master's advisor, Marty Jaffe, who was a big innovator and whose work is very well received within academic study of rabbinic literature. But in any case, in this course, Contemporary Judaisms, we... even though we want to talk about what's going on in with the quote-unquote Judaisms of the world today, I have to trace it back to the Midrashim. I have to go all the way back to the Mishnah and kind of do a big, you know, overview and then a fast-forward through the medieval time.
Okay, hang on just a sec. Before you go on, because I want to make sure that people who are listening, if you aren't aware of some of the books that Rob's talking about right now, first let's date the Tosefta, the Mishnah, and the Talmud for those who might be listening.
Well, dating is always trouble because we got – but we typically will say that the Mishnah, capital M, was compiled by – Judah the Prince, or Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, around 200, Common Era.
Okay.
And the Tosefta seems to be... Now, the problem with all this is that our manuscript evidence is much later.
You think that the Mishnah was compiled or the Tosefta was compiled in 200?
The Mishnah is basically said to the early 200s.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, between two... You know,
see, because I was placing it in the 300s, but okay, keep going. You're the scholar.
Well, they'll say early 3rd century, which is really 200.
200, you know? Okay, yeah.
So maybe that's what where you got the 3 there. But in any case, and it seems that the Tosefta covers the same terrain as the Mishnah, but it's not as refined in language, and it's not as tightly organized.
Okay.
And so there seems to be a relationship between the textual traditions that we have called Tosefta and the main textual tradition called Mishnah. But the Mishnah seems to be like a more concise and more defined on halakhic matters than the Tosefta. And then in any case, so those are all written in Hebrew. They're written in what's called Mishnaic Hebrew. It's kind of an Aramaic influence Hebrew. And then later we have the Jerusalem Talmud called the Talmud Yerushalmi, or sometimes the Palestinian Talmud, because it technically didn't come from Jerusalem because it was up north in the Galilee. But in any case, that's dated to the, you know, 3rd to 4th century. And that's now Mishnah with Gemara, with commentary in Aramaic.
Okay.
And then sections of Tosefta are woven into that conversation. So basically we have later Aramaic-speaking rabbis who are discussing the meaning of this or that Mishnah, and in that conversation, and this conversation is going on in Aramaic, while they're having this conversation, they're quoting from what we would call the Tosefta, these other Hebrew texts received from earlier generation of Tanaim. And then, of course, finally in Babylon, we have the completion of the Babylonian Talmud, which is 5th to 6th century, so it's much later, and is quite a different animal than the Yerushalmi, than the Jerusalem Talmud. Anyway, why is this important? Well, and then we see how these texts, how the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud are received in the medieval Jewish era in Europe. So we have kind of the rise of Islam, you know, and then you have different, you know, kind of battles between Christians and Muslims, et cetera, over ruling different parts of Europe. And then you have Jewish communities negotiating their own authority with whoever's in charge at the time to rule their own communities. And you have the desire to have Jewish authority and what is the true authority. And you have some communities looking now to the Talmud or Babylonian Talmud rather than to living rabbis for halakha. And you have all sorts of stuff happens, you know, in the Middle Ages.
Okay, so let's pull it back to Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva.
Yeah, but in any case, so the Babylonian Talmud ends up being the true authority by the medieval European Jewish, you know, by the time.
And we should make a disclaimer here for those who might, you know, if this is the first Rob and Caleb show that you're listening to, the Jewish faith today, the traditional Jewish faith, I guess I could say, would take the Talmud and the Mishnah as scripture, essentially, as God breathed.
Yeah, it's holy text. Yeah,
whereas, of course, we do not. We like reading these texts to give us insight into what was going on in specific periods in time in the Jewish cultures, and insights into the Bible sometimes, because some of these rabbis, that's, you know, what they did. They spent time in the Word.
Okay, so so Caleb asks about this difference between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out, you know, because not only in the Mishnah and Tosefta, but we have other Tanaitic writings. So Mishnaic Hebrew commentary on the Book of Exodus, you know, for example, that's the Mechilta of Rabbi Ishmael. We have the Sifra, you know, the Sifrei. Anyway, for those who have taken Introduction to Rabbinic Literature, you'll be familiar with this. In any case, from the if all we had was the Jerusalem Talmud, we would have a conception of the early rabbinic discipleship communities as split along two lines. One is the school of Rabbi Ishmael. The other is the school of Rabbi Akiva. Both of these are second century Jewish sages who had a unique perspective on the nature of exegesis. According to the Jerusalem Talmud, each of these schools, or each of these, you know, Ishmael had some disciples, Akiva had some disciples, and they did not look at the Torah the same way. And the school of Ishmael had a kind of a basic tenet that the Torah was given, or the Torah speaks in Lashon Adam, in the language of Adam, the language of man. And that...
So common human language.
Common human language.
Okay, and I would agree with that.
Whereas the school of Rabbi Akiva believed that every letter...
It was Lashon HaKodesh.
Yeah, that it wasn't given in the language of man. Rather, it's a divine language. It's a code that needs to be...
Broken.
Broken and, decoded or to decipher.
And
not only that, Akiva believed that there's little extra marks that the scribal tradition had on certain letters even had interpretive meaning. And not only that, Akiva believed that anything that was repeated in the Torah have a different interpretation for each repetition, whereas Ishmael thought that was ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's... what Akiva's approach does is opens the door to all sorts of interpretations of the scriptures. You know, one of the big I think it's an anti-gospel polemic. It's in the Babylonian Talmud. Basically, it's, you know, that Moses is shown Rabbi Akiva while he's on Mount Sinai. In other words, so during the revelation of the Torah on Mount Sinai, Moses, this is a rabbinic legend, right, that the Moses sees the Holy One writing a Torah scroll and putting these little
crowns,
extra little crowns on the letters. And he says, what are those? And God says, Moses, oh, there's going to be a sage in centuries to come named Rabbi Akiva, and he's going to interpret heaps and heaps of halachot off of these little letters.
Halachot meaning?
Meaning law, Jewish laws.
Okay.
And that, like, somehow God was rejoicing in these. And Moses then asked to see, and it goes through basically a divine time travel procedure, you know, and gets to go to a little study circle where Akiva, you know, is teaching. And Moses doesn't understand anything and is concerned and says to God, I don't understand what's going on here. But then he finally hears Akiva says, thus it was delivered to Moses at Sinai. And then Moses is going, he takes a breath of fresh air and he's like, oh, good. So in any case,
Moses didn't even know what was being said. He's like, oh, okay, fine. Yeah. It came through me. That's good.
Yeah. But in any case, you know, but the Akivan tradition is to take little words like the et, for example, or rock or ak, these little words, and attribute great significance to them halakhically.
Hang on just a second. Let's stop right there too, because does every single letter in the Torah matter? The answer is absolutely. You know, even Yeshua says that. So it's not that they don't have specific meaning and that they don't have, you know, that each one of them is not just as weightier as the other letter. But the point is that we can't get extra meaning. Well, I guess we're going to get to that. Keep going.
Well, so anyway, by the there are several stories about Rabbi Akiva. And one of the things is Akiva is said to be the only sage who ascended. He went into paradise. And he came back in shalom, it says, where these other rabbis either died or something else happened to them because they didn't have the power. He taught that the Merkabah, you know, the Merkabah is, you know, the divine throne of God was the true thing to be meditating on.
Okay, hang on.
He had all sorts of mystical teachings.
Hang on just a second. I want to explain the Merkabah, and there's something in rabbinic literature called the Merkabah literature or the Merkabah texts. This has to do with it translated the chariot, and so there's a lot of mystical lore about, you know, well,
yeah, first speculation on Ezekiel chapter 1.
Yeah, and Elisha
and,
being
Genesis 1
being taken up, or Elijah being taken up by the chariot, and basically even Rabbi Akiva said that at one point he was taken up to heaven in the Merkabah. He saw the different heavens and all this kind of stuff. So, Merkabah, there's a whole plethora of literature on this. And actually, a book that I read that explained, well, and not necessarily that I would recommend this book, but one book that deals a lot with the difference between Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva and the mystic side of things as opposed to the Ishmael side of things is a book by Abraham Heschel, Heavenly Torah, which was the last book he wrote before he died. Okay, I'm sorry for interrupting. Keep going, Rob.
No, that's good. And so in any case, Akiva, as you know, he comes and goes, but he leaves a legacy of interpreting the Hebrew alphabet a certain way. Each letter has its own meaning, and there's a midrash called the Alphabet of Rabbi Akiva that comes out by the Middle Ages. That's a popular book. And we have a whole tradition that then becomes embodied in the book called the Zohar in around, you know, in the 1200s in Spain, that is a continued expansion on this type of view of the Torah, where there is significance to each letter, that there's some sort of mysterious or cosmic power associated with each letter. And this comes into the rabbinic Kabbalistic tradition subsequently and influences Hasidism, for example.
Okay, so wait, hang on just a sec. We're moving exactly where I want to move to, but that's exactly that. So let's talk about this for just the relationship. So it seems like what you're saying and what I'm going to try to tie together here now is that Rabbi Akiva started this tradition of every single letter has a specific meaning, and when we know this, the more spiritual you are, the closer to God you are, the more you're going to understand. And this actually morphed over the centuries and moved into a different direction, into what we would call in modern times Kabbalah. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, and if you just go to the internet and you look up books, I've just real quickly I pulled up a couple books. There's The Wisdom in the Hebrew Alphabet by Art Scroll, and the subtitle there is The Sacred Letters as a Guide to Jewish Deed and Thought.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about like the Aleph being, he gives a picture of the word picture, right? He's got the word picture, and he says how it means leader or chief. So it's
the
even though now
this
is an Orthodox Jewish context.
Yeah, the Art Scroll is not Messianic.
Right, exactly. So it's an Orthodox Jewish publication, Art Scroll is, and it's got Hasidic, or it's got Lubavitch influence in the leadership. But in any case, it's doing the similar thing that we saw with Hebrew for Christians or these other guys. Another book is Rav Berg, The Energy of Hebrew Letters.
Okay, but hang on just a sec. I want to go back to, so let's expound this for, because some people might not know anything about Kabbalah except for, there was this push by Madonna and a couple other people to wear red strings at some point. They think that Kabbalah is an actual book. So it's not, though.
Yeah, it's not. No, it's a tradition.
Okay, so Kabbalah is basically different teachings from rabbis that can be found throughout different rabbinical literature. Am I correct on that?
Right. Yeah, and there's different facets of emphasis that can be umbrellaed underneath the idea of Kabbalism. For example, one stream would be the interpretive stream that says that the world, and it's generally found in the Zohar, that God is the only truly existent one, and that everything else is more or less illusion.
Mm.
So in other words, sin is kind of like an illusion. It's not real.
Well, I want to give a couple of examples. And for those of you who might not know, when I years and years and years and years ago, I was able to travel to Israel, and I had some very interesting experiences there. But my brushes with the Kabbalistic Judaism in Jerusalem, I had several of them. One of them was with a gentleman who was a Breslover, and he flat out told me that he believed in reincarnation.
Now that's a Kabbalistic teaching.
Okay, so that's not something that I would have equated to Judaism. I would have not thought that Judaism would have taught reincarnation.
Well, it's funny because I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the things that is quote unquote Hebraic or Jewish thought that I've seen creep over into particularly the Chuck Missler and some of these guys, they talk about tikkun olam, the repairing of the world, as if they know what they're talking about. When in fact, the whole framework for understanding the Kabbalistic notion of tikkun has to do with is reincarnation is an aspect of that. But yet, you don't
hear that from Mizra.
You don't hear that on the Christians who talk about tikkun. They don't maybe understand that the actual framework that they're talking about is one that has to do with Gilgul HaNefesh, reincarnation of souls.
I want to give one more example, because for those listening, the reason that I want to tell these little stories is not to, basically what I'm trying to do here is show different facets of what Kabbalism is. And I'm going to tie this back in at some point. And I'm not saying that as someone who has studied, a couple of rabbinic texts that might be mystical, or someone who has endeavored to read, different rabbinic mystical texts, that they're doing, that they're dabbling with something that they possibly shouldn't. I mean, maybe they are, maybe they're not. But my point is that Kabbalism as a whole encompasses is something that obviously is not biblical. It's something that has gone off from the Bible and has turned into something completely different. So, I mean, there is certain things to be gained from rabbinical studies, but and somebody accused me of saying that if they were teaching their congregation, you know, something that might be a little bit mystical, that I was saying that they were teaching their congregation witchcraft. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that Kabbalah tends to twist things in a way that is very odd. And in some cases, I believe it does become, it does cross over into the occult. And that doesn't mean that if you take something and, you know, expound on a teaching on something that you've found to your congregation, that you're then teaching them witchcraft. That's not the point. But I went to a music concert one time, and out in the parking lot, before we got into the actual arena where this music concert was, there were a bunch of Orthodox Jews, and they were asking people if they were Jewish and then rapping tefillin on people. And this was not a religious concert by any stretch of the imagination. And so the gentleman asked me, "Are you Jewish?" And I said, "I am Jewish." And he said, "Well, have you wrapped tefillin today?" And I said, "No, I haven't." So he put the tefillin on me and he asked me to say the Shema. Well, why would he think that I needed to do that? One line of thought is that if all of the Jewish men in one generation don tefillin, that the Messiah will come. So it's a Kabbalistic belief,
right,
that it's basically trying to control God.
They believe that's exact. Thank you for putting it that way. There's one a strong theme in Kabbalistic circles now, not all, because some are based on just the person experiencing a certain state of spiritual ascent. But another stream of Kabbalism is actually influencing God. It's what Moshe Idel, who's one of the big names in Jewish mystical studies at Hebrew University, theurgy. In other words, it's an effort to control the Godhead through means of doing certain things, reciting certain letter combinations, doing and exactly that. When you do something like a certain mitzvah with the proper intention, you're actually restoring God. You're actually helping fix the broken vessels.
And
you're
Rob,
you're repairing the world.
That's the whole idea between Kabbalistic prayer. A lot of the Kabbalists believe that when you pray the morning prayers, you can't say any of your own prayers. You have to stick strictly to the prayer book. The reason why is because they believe that there's these wars going on in heaven and that our words directly affect that war. For those listening, you might think, where in the world are they going with this? Why are they even talking about this? Well, the point is that, yes, this is very, there are some very strange beliefs in Kabbalism. And I'm not saying that everything, quote unquote, mystical is necessarily bad. It seems like we have some, you know, some somewhat mystical things in the apostolic scriptures. Paul says, "I knew a man," whether or not he's talking about himself or not, you know, that's up for debate. But I knew a man who went to, the third heaven. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there are these, now, I wouldn't call them mystical personally, but others might. But the whole point of talking about Kabbalah and this whole mystical side of Judaism is that that is exactly what people are trying to do with putting pictures to the letters and then reinterpreting the Bible according to these pictures.
Yeah, I think that both the Paleo Hebrew word picture proponents out there and the Hebrew mystical letter proponents, such as, you know, these, the Art Scroll and the Rav Berg, you know, energy of the Hebrew letters, and Rabbi Kushner's The Book of Letters, mystical Hebrew alphabet. You know, these are all in the Orthodox or quote unquote Jewish side. They're ultimately accomplishing the same thing, and the way I would say they're different manifestations of a basic principle. They're assigning specific meanings or significances to each Hebrew letter, and then applying that meaning in interpretation of words and of other, these, they get into this idea of energies, cosmic original energies, etc. And it's historically, this stems from the school of Rabbi Akiva. This is an important point. And I believe that disciples of Yeshua would not want to align themselves with an interpretive scheme that has a demonstrated history of bad fruit. In other words, a proven track record of false Messiah claims.
Exactly.
And if I could just take a minute, here, for example, starting with Akiva himself, he pronounced Bar Kosaba Melech Mashiach. Okay, so that wasn't Ishmael that did that. It was Rabbi Akiva. And he was the one known for these strange interpretive approaches to the Torah. Now, he's in the second century, but he's strongly associated subsequently within rabbinic tradition as master of the mysteries of the Hebrew letters. And the Babylonian Talmud, which kind of wipes away Rabbi Ishmael and focuses, it becomes basically the Akivan tradition with a little of Ishmael sprinkled here and there, becomes the dominant text for medieval Jewry. But also the Kabbalistic tradition draws on this mystical hermeneutic. In the 13th century, we had Abraham Abulafia. He presented himself as a Messiah, and he was all on meditation on the letters and then changing the combinations of the letters and pronouncing them. Shabbatai Tzvi in the 17th century was a pro-Zohar mystic. He believed he was the Messiah. And Jacob Frank in the 18th century, that got to such an extreme that they were pro-Zohar but anti-Talmud. But he said he was a reincarnation of Shabbatai Tzvi and the patriarch Jacob. And of course, we have in Hasidism, we have Schneerson in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Believers think he's the Messiah, and that stems from the same Kabbalistic
when you say believers,
tradition.
Not obviously not believers in Yeshua, but certain Jewish believers in Schneerson.
In other words, the data is out. Data is out. If you look at the history of false messianic claims within the Jewish tradition, they inevitably are associated with Rabbi Akiva's exegesis of the Hebrew letters, not with Rabbi Ishmael. And not only that, Yeshua says, by your fruits you shall know them. And he also says that there's going to be a lot of messianic claims. And he says, don't believe them. So why would I want, as a disciple of Yeshua, why do I want to play with this kind of stuff?
Well, and you know, one of the points that might be brought up by somebody who is a proponent of these Hebrew picture letter, you know, that whole theory, one of the claims might be, well, you know, it seems like there's some, you know, nobody's going off and saying, oh, you know, this, you know, Hebrews needs to be ripped out of your Bible because this says this, or, you know, nothing like that. It's all good stuff, you know. We find the name of God here, and we, you know, all these kind of little things. But you know what? That's how it starts. When you use a bad hermeneutic, when you use a bad interpretation to try to expound things from the Word of God and things that we're going to live our lives by, things that we're going to rest our not only our faith but our salvation, and you know, live our lives, we'll live and die by the things that are going to come from this book. When you're talking about the interpretation of that word, as soon as you start to use a bad hermeneutic where you can pull new things out of different texts and find these things that have never been seen before, there is something that's wrong with that. And I'm sorry, but I just don't see how this is benefiting anyone in the Messianic communities. In fact, I think it's detrimental. But beyond that, you know, any good scholar that I've found, and I'm willing to have somebody tell me otherwise, but, you know, and people keep saying, oh, look at this person or look at this person. All the people that are advocating this seem to have no education whatsoever when it comes to the biblical languages, except for being self-taught. And I'm willing to be proved wrong on that.
Yeah. If here's the other thing. I might be drawn and quartered for saying this, but I think this is a dangerous, very dangerous interpretive approach. And I think that those who are in Messiah Yeshua, who are either just exploring this, they're playing around with it, or they've embraced this Hebrew letter hermeneutics, mm-hmm. I think they, like these other people from the Jewish tradition, they're in danger of misidentifying Messiah.
Yeah.
In other words, they're in danger of constructing through their imaginations, informed by this commitment to these word pictures, a false picture of Yeshua.
Yeah. And of God in general. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the mystery, Yeshua says this. He says, nothing is covered up that will not be revealed. Nothing is hidden that will not be known. Whatever you have said in the dark shall be heard in the light. In other words, he says, whatever you hear whispered, proclaim on the housetops. The mystery, the great mystery, has already been revealed, and it's God in the flesh. It's Yeshua, Messiah.
That's absolutely right.
Who's given us his spirit, and he's in you, Caleb, and he's in me. And it's by his spirit that we are called sons of God.
That's right.
And that's the mystery, and that we're to love one another in that knowledge, and we're to put, you know, seek heaven first in all things in that knowledge, in the fellowship that we have, in the joy we have, that Yeshua did something on our behalf, not because we did something to deserve it or to earn it, but because out of just love. It's not a motivation. Like one of the Kabbalistic streams is that, like, God needs our help. You know, God just loves us.
That's
and
right.
He did something to restore. Sin is not an illusion. The reality is not illusion. The reality is that sin costs, and that, like it says in Hebrews and throughout the Torah, that without the shedding of blood, there's no remission of sin. Sin is real. The consequences of sin is real. No matter what, so this Kabbalistic idea that you can somehow imagine yourself into, like, becoming one with God, and that sin is not, that sin is illusion or anything like that, or that all you have to do is repent and that there didn't have to be any shed blood. I mean, it's very problematic, and we're getting into spiritual things, but we know that there are, in the heavenly realms, as it says in Paul, you know, there are powers that are contrary to the gospel at work.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to, if we stick to the simple gospel message, the simple scriptures that we have, and not get distracted by word pictures and spending time on all this imaginative, speculative things, when we could just be learning the simple languages and studying history
right.
better, and learning how can we better communicate the gospel, let's say, with Orthodox Jews or with Muslims or with our the Mormons that come to our door. You know, I mean, there's so many other things that we can put the wonderful intelligences that God has given us, you know,
mm-hmm.
into a way that will be, Be'ezrat Hashem, glorifying to Yeshua and helping do our part for the kingdom that he's called us to.
That's right. All right. Well, hey, listen, we're going to take a quick break. Before we do that, I just want to let everyone know this whole month of January, this past month of January, we've been running an interview that I did with Dr. N.T. Wright. That interview will stop playing now once January is over, and you'll be able to hear a new interview with a new scholar. And I interviewed Dr. Paul Wagner with Golden Gate Baptist Seminary, and we just had a really good time together. I definitely don't agree with everything that Dr. Wagner said, but you will be able to hear that interview starting on February 3rd. It'll play three times a week throughout the month of February. So make sure to check our schedule page for that and tune in. Well, when we come back from break, we have a guest who contacted me and said, I'm willing to challenge the mighty Van Hoff to a game of trivia. So when we come back, we're going to get him on the line while we're on break, and we're going to bring him on air, and we are going to play a good spirited round of trivia between Mr. Van Hoff and our guest. So stay tuned for that. We'll be right back after this. All right, welcome back to the Rob and Caleb Show. We've been talking about all sorts of different things, and now we have a very special treat with us now. Joining us during the break, we gave a call to one of our listeners, Nathan. Hello, Nathan, how are you?
Doing well, Caleb. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So Nathan has challenged the mighty Rob Van Hoff to a game of trivia. And the way this is going to work is we're going to give a minute and a half for 10 questions to both Nathan and then also to Mr. Van Hoff. And whoever gets the most right wins. And there will be a prize involved for whoever wins. So Nathan, you're going to be first. Are you ready for your questions?
Yes, sir.
All right. Number one, how many books are in the Bible?
66.
That is correct. What was the name of Moses' father-in-law?
Oh, boy. Jethro.
That is also correct. 2 for 2. In which tribe was the city of Bethlehem?
Judah.
That is also correct. Man, he's killing it. Who was appointed to replace Judas Iscariot as a disciple?
I think it was Mattathias.
That is also correct. We'll accept that. How long did Jonah say it would be before Nineveh was to be overthrown?
Oh, boy. That's 40 days?
That's also correct. What weight of gold was Solomon recorded as acquiring in 1 year? That's a hard one.
I know that's in talents. 240 talents.
Wow. That is incorrect. 666 talents. You were close. How many times did Yeshua say you should forgive your brother when he sins against you?
490. 70 times 7.
That is also correct. Who did Luke write his gospel to?
Forget the name. Don't know.
Not a problem. Which Bible doctrine did the Sadducees reject?
The resurrection.
That is also correct. For how many years had the woman with the issue of blood suffered before she was healed by Yeshua?
I don't know.
Time's up anyway. All right, not a problem. Let's see here. You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. All right, the ones you missed were number 6. What weight of gold was Solomon recorded as acquiring in 1 year? The answer was 666 talents. Who did Luke write his gospel to? Theophilus. And how many years did the woman suffer from the blood? It was 12 years. All right, Rob, this is going to be difficult.
Okay, I'm leaving.
All right, Rob, are you ready for your questions?
No, but go for it.
All right, here you go, Rob. Name the 5 books of the Torah.
In what language?
Ha, 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 ha.
No, okay, so Bereshit, Shemot, Vayikra, Bamidbar, and Devarim.
Show off. In Exodus 25:6, the word translated spices is used two times, but with 2 different spellings. Name the Hebrew word and its 2 different spellings.
Well, I think it's, is it Besamim?
That's correct.
But is it one time without a yod, I believe? But I don't know for sure.
That's incorrect. The correct answer is once with a somic, once with a sin.
Okay.
In which tribe was the city of Ramoth Gilead?
Oh, golly. Is that in Ephraim?
That's incorrect. The correct answer is Gad. How many begotten sons of David are named in the Bible?
Oh, my. I don't know. 12?
19. The disciple Thomas was also known as Didymus, but what does this name mean?
Twin.
That is correct. In Genesis 16:6, God tells Noah to build an ark with this in it. We are looking for the Hebrew word.
With something in it, or what it's made of?
With something in it, built into it.
I don't know. Gopher.
Zohar, also known as window. Which 3 tribes camped on the northern side of the tabernacle in the wilderness?
The north side, maybe Manasseh, Gad, and Ephraim?
That is incorrect. Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. How old was Josiah when he became king of Judah?
8 years old.
That's correct. And we are out of time. All right, so you both missed the last question, but Nathan, you just slaughtered Mr. Van Hoff.
Right on, Nathan.
All right, Nate.
This wasn't your day, Rob.
Nate, you just won a $20 gift certificate to TorahResource.com. And
right.
You will be contacted with information on that. We appreciate you playing with us on the Rob and Caleb Show.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Well done, Nathan. Well done.
All right, brother. Thank you so much. Nate. We will talk to you again hopefully someday soon. Rob, I'm sorry, but the questions were a little bit harder for you, but I figured you could handle it.
No problem. Hey, that's great. I Baruch Hashem that Nathan, that's just a lot of trivia there that I think a lot of people wouldn't have got.
He killed it. And the other interesting thing that I did during the break, I haven't even told Rob this yet, but I did contact Michael Brown, who many of you will know who Michael Brown is. Michael Brown has written a series of books entitled Jewish Objections to Jesus. He also has his own radio show. He has a blog. He's a prolific writer. And come to find out, he has his doctorate. I believe it's in Semitic languages. Is that correct, Rob? Do you know?
Yeah, I believe so, from NYU, which is a an amazing Jewish studies program.
That's right. I contacted him during the break, and guess what? He has agreed to come on to the Rob and Caleb show with us and to talk about the development of language and to talk about basically what we've talked about. I mean, you might think that we're beating a dead horse with a stick here on, pictures in language and all that kind of stuff. But I wanted to talk to Dr. Brown because he has his PhD in language and Semitic languages. And I would consider him not only very well learned, but somewhat of an authority on the issue. So he has agreed to come on to the show with us. We're not going to do it today. We're going to set up a time with Dr. Brown to talk to him, and he's going to hopefully help us straighten some of this out as well. So we look forward to that. Well, I hope that you've enjoyed this show. I hope we've cleared up some things for you. And we sure had fun. Thanks again to Nathan for coming on to the show with us. And we will try to set up that interview with Dr. Brown so that we can all learn a little something more about our great God and Savior, Yeshua the Messiah.